Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, coming up today, two award-winning authors who've each captured a huge reader base. We end today's show with the award-winning poet and best-selling author of Good Bones, Maggie Smith. She discusses her latest release, Goldenrod, a collection of poems that celebrates the beauty and messiness of life. And goodness knows we know it can be both, right? I have to confess I'd not read any of Maggie Smith's work before, but now I want more. Anyway, that's coming up in the second part of today's show. Coming up first, a listener favorite joins us. She's number one best-selling author, Susan Wiggs. And you might remember that Susan joined us last year to talk about her latest novel, The Lost and Found Bookshop. That conversation you can find on our website at conversationslive.net. Now, that book is now out in paperback as a special book club edition. And so Susan's come along today to talk to us a little bit about that. The story, just to recap, explores the meaning of happiness, trust, and faith in oneself, and asks the question, if you had to start over, what would you do and who would you be? So add Susan Wiggs' The Lost and Found Bookshop to your summer reading or book club list for sure. Today, I asked Susan to join us to share a few summer reading recommendations. Grab a pen and paper if you want to capture author names and book titles. And let's dive in now to hear about some of Susan Wiggs' favorite books this summer. Here's my guest, Susan Wiggs. Susan Wiggs, thank you for joining us today. And I'm so pleased to have you with us.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, you know what? It's about a year since we last talked. And in my mind, when I was putting a couple of notes together here, I thought it was a couple of months ago, and it's been a whole year. And we talked about the launch of the Lost and Found Bookshop last year. And I had a lot of fun researching background for that particular story. We talked about that. Now the paperback is out. So tell us what's happening around that.
Well, it's been a really kind of fun time to publish a new book just as the world is kind of opening back up. So my publisher decided to do a special book club edition because people are going to start getting together again, and that means book clubs are going to start getting together again. So they created this kind of yummy looking cover, you know, a woman in a yellow dress, and she's offering a stack of books to, you know, just to the viewer. And then in the back they have I think there's an interview and some reading group questions, and not to be missed, the best recipe that I could possibly give a book club for my very famous moist banana bread. Because getting together with books means also snacks, so.
Of course. So
it's kind of fun. Yeah, it's fun to have, to think about people being able to get together again. I've been to so many Zoom book club meetings, and they're certainly fun, and we've made them work, but there's nothing quite like getting together with your friends and talking about books. So this edition of the Lost and Found Bookshop is kind of a celebration and a shout out to that. So I'm really excited to have it out. It's just out this month.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful. And I did take a quick look at your website, but where's the best place for people to find out what's happening, you know, as we continue to open up, touch wood, hopefully we do?
Probably starting on my website, but then my social media channels always have that immediacy. My Instagram feed usually shows, you know, where I am at any given moment, and my Twitter feed shows what I'm thinking at any given moment. That's right. Not always pretty, but it's a way to really stay in touch. And of course, I have my lovely, lovely Facebook author page, where the readers are kind of make that page a meeting place. And in fact, it got so busy that we did a spin-off from my Susan Wiggs author page on Facebook to a book club club page called the Never Alone Book Club, because there's a quote that's attributed to me, so I guess I said it, and the quote is, "You're never alone when you're reading a book."
Awesome.
So it's called the Never Alone Book Group on Facebook. I think you can Google that and just find me there. But we talk about, it's sort of like a very, very loosely organized book club. And we don't all read the same book, but we share what we're reading and we talk about our thoughts around that. And so that's been really fun, too. And it sort of filled in the gaps of not being able to get together with readers so much.
Yeah, getting creative. That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, it is that time of year when, I don't know why, but for some reason, I read a lot of fiction in the summer that I normally don't read, and I'm guessing other people are the same. Nothing nicer than sitting out in the garden looking over the water, you know, reading a book as the sun sets, I think. And so you've sorted out some of your favorite books, some books that you'd recommend for us. So can we get started and take a look at those? And the first one I think you're going to talk about is Bravery by Alexis Pappas.
No, oh, Bravey.
Bravey. Bravey.
It looks like
I told you I wouldn't be able to
read
my writing.
Bravey. Bravey by Alexis Pappas. And she's an Olympian. She's an Olympic athlete, but she has a really, really difficult background. Her mother suffered from bipolar syndrome, and she was basically raised in kind of a haphazard fashion, but she's a runner. And she's an Olympic runner. I think she's also an actress and filmmaker, and she kind of shares her journey. She's a young woman, and so I love the whole, the energy of this book. It was just really inspiring to me.
Right, and so that's a memoir.
One of those, heartbreaking and funny is kind of how I would categorize it.
Right, and so does she focus on a particular period of her life, or is it chronological? How does that...
Yeah, she's so young.
Yeah.
She's still in her 20s, so, the first 20 years. But, she does focus on, recovering from such an enormous trauma as losing your mother at a young age.
Right.
And she battled depression, and she's really, really honest about it. But she's also exuberant and she just has this can-do attitude. And it was just a really uplifting book to read at the end of, I hope we're at the end of our pandemic. And it just kind of was a forward-looking, lovely book. And so I've been recommending that. It's one that I would recommend, especially to any young woman who's kind of facing those issues that we face in our 20s, I would say.
Mm, perfect. And so you have one that's set, I believe, in the 70s, a retro kind of story, the final revival of Opal and Nav.
Yes. And that one, I believe Nav is a Brit, so that would be a good one for you. It's called The Final Revival of Opal and Nav, and it's by Dawnie, Dawnie Walton. And it's about the rise of this interracial rock duo in the 70s. They're fictional, but it reads like a Rolling Stone memoir or something like that. But it's really cool. And it's the woman is just so fierce and so independent, and her name's Opal. And anyway, it spans from the 70s to, I think, like 2016. They're going to have a reunion after, getting their start together in the 70s. And it was just such a good read, one of those carry you away. And, even if you weren't around in the 70s, it kind of gives you the flavor of that time period juxtaposed against, contemporary times. So
yeah,
I enjoyed that one a lot.
It's interesting. There seems to be a revival all round of interest in the 70s. I just saw a couple of movies. Don't ask me their names. I can't remember. I'm terrible with names. But I just watched a couple of movies from the 70s, and I was like, I don't remember that. But interesting. All right, so then we've got a one by Viola Shipman, The Clover Girls. What's that all about?
Well, this was sent to to me for an endorsement, and I was so happy to get it because it sounded like the not only the kind of book I love to read, but the kind of book that I would write. It's a reunion of four women. They're women now, but we go from the 70s to the 80s because they were girls in the 80s. They went to summer camp together, and now, you know, it's many years later, and they all come together. They're middle-aged women facing challenges that, you know, they never anticipated when they were young, and how they sort through these and support each other through these. And anybody who reads Susan Wiggs' books knows I like to write stories about women supporting women and, you know, coming together and sorting out their problems. So anyway, The Clover Girls was, it was such a good read, and I believe it's also brand new this month.
Okay. Is that a debut novel, or has Viola Shipman written other books?
I think she's had some other books, but she's new-ish, new to me, and I was so happy to make her acquaintance, and so that was a nice surprise that I got. That's one of the perks of being a writer, is they send you books to review and possibly endorse. And it's been kind of fun for me to have a book out about a bookseller, the Lost and Found Bookshop, because I get to like sound like a bookseller. I'm not,
right.
I'm no expert at it, but I'm definitely an expert reader.
Yeah, well, I know you did a ton of research for that book, so I think it's pretty on the mark there. And the last book that you're going to talk about as a suggestion for summer reading, You Don't Belong Here, and that's by Elizabeth Becker.
Now, this one is I wouldn't call it light reading, but it's very compelling reading. It's about three women I'd never heard of, and they're amazing. They're three of them in wartime. There was a French wartime photographer, and I'm going to forget her name, but anyway, and then one of them was an Australian kind of rebel iconoclast type, and another one was an American intellectual. Anyway, they kind of challenged the rules about covering the military and covering the war, and all of them, their work illuminated pieces of the Vietnam War that I never learned about in school. And so, like I said, it's not light reading or summer reading, but it was so compelling. And they really had to fight their way into this niche in the 60s and early 70s, because that's what they were told. That's why it's called You Don't Belong Here. And they were challenged, and they persisted, and their work is just amazing. And some of the illustrations in the book just kind of blew me away. I'd never seen them before. And so it kind of fills a void, because I think that, as familiar as we think we are with stories about the war, the women's roles are, still underreported. So that one I definitely recommend. And it's out, I think it's a 2020 publication.
Okay, good. And again, that's You Don't Belong Here by Elizabeth Becker. You know, I talk with a lot of historical fiction writers, obviously, over the years, and it's amazing how many really interesting stories never come to light and make it, in the public domain until somebody writes a book about it, a fiction book about it. So it's all good work, right?
It is. And I'm always so happy to dig into something, in some obscure way. I love the little side trips that we make in historical fiction that kind of illuminate a little known piece of history.
Mm. Well, I really appreciate you sharing those four books with us. Do you have a favorite summer drink that you like to sip while you're reading?
I do. I kind of made this one up, and I made it up in honor of Mackenzie Scott. And people might not know her by name, but she's a writer, and she's also the ex-wife of Jeff Bezos, Amazon. And, she ended her marriage at a very with a lot of money, and she's been giving it away. And she actually funded a nonprofit that my daughter-in-law works for. That's a healthcare nonprofit. She funded it to the tune of $15 million. And I thought, well, what a lovely thing to do. Mm. And so I made a drink called the Mackenzie Scott. And
I
it's
love it.
Equal parts. I always have to do equal parts because I can't remember things. So equal parts Empress Gin, which is that beautiful lavender-colored gin, lemon, elderflower liqueur. There's one called Saint Germain that's in a really pretty bottle. And just put a sprig of lavender in it and a splash of tonic on top of that.
Wow. That sounds pretty nice. And it probably looks pretty nice too, right? With the colors.
I didn't even know you were going to ask me about that, but I just had it on the tip of my tongue.
I know. I thought I just, well, you can't, you know, you have to have a nice drink when you're reading out in the evening.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You'll have to include that in one of your books because I know you often put recipes in them. So I want to remind listeners that the Lost and Found Bookshop is now out in paperback, and they can find our original conversation about the Lost and Found Bookshop and the writing life on conversationslive.net. And actually, there's three other podcasts, I think, up there with you too, Susan, on some of your other books. So
can't get rid of me. I keep coming back.
There you go. So what are your plans for the next couple of weeks? How are you going to enjoy summer?
I'm going to do a lot of reading. I'm actually working on the revisions on a book. So it's not my favorite part of a book because it's done and I want it to be done. But of course, I need to, you know, perfect everything. So I'm just going to be working on that this summer. And I'll be home a lot because, as you know, we live in the Pacific Northwest where, you know, we have these amazing summers that we wait all year to experience. So I'm going to stick close to home, do a little boating. And, a lot of reading.
Yeah, sounds good. Especially the boating. I love boating. So listeners can find out much more about you at susanwiggs.com. Final thought you'd like to leave them with today, Susan?
Final thought is get a book and share a book. I've been trying to do more sharing of my books, and it's kind of lightened my load. I actually did own a lot of books, and so and I'll never not buy books or borrow books, but I've started a new habit, and that is share a book. And I try to match things up. It's kind of fun to be a book matchmaker. So, think about that as we're reading. Who would love this book as much as I'm loving it?
Yeah, that sounds great. That's a good idea. We have a lot of those little libraries where I live. You know, the little, they look like
little free library.
Yeah, they look like little bird houses, but they're libraries. I think they're so cool.
I do too.
All right. Well, thank you, Susan, and enjoy the rest of your summer. SusanWiggs.com is where people can find out more about you and your work. Thanks for being with us.
You're so welcome. Have a great day.
All right. Coming up next, I'm joined by Pushcart Prize-winning poet Maggie Smith. She gained star status in 2016 with her viral poem, Good Bones. Long celebrated in the poetry community for her lyricism and style, Maggie's poetry has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the Paris Review. Slate magazine called her superpower as a writer, her ability to find the perfect concrete metaphor for inchoate human emotions and explore it with empathy and honesty. So the poems in her new collection, Goldenrod, celebrate the contours of daily life. They explore the space between thought and experience and remind us that at the end of the day, we decide what is beautiful. So Maggie Smith is the best-selling author of Good Bones, The Well Speaks of Its Own Poison, Lamp of the Body, and the national bestseller Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change. She's a 2011 recipient of a creative writing fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts and has received several individual excellence awards from the Ohio Arts Council, two Academy of American Poets Prizes, a Pushcart Prize, and fellowships from the Sustainable Arts Foundation, and the list goes on there. You can find out more about Maggie at her website, maggiesmithpoet.com. So let me bring on Maggie Smith with her latest collection of poems, Goldenrod. Maggie Smith, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I have to confess, I have not read your work before, but after reading Goldenrod, I want more. So I'm really pleased you're joining us today.
Oh, thank you. What a high compliment.
So let's just begin with a little of your background, Maggie. A lot of teenagers go through a phase of writing poetry. I did. I know my brother did. Some of my friends at school did. And I heard that's when it started for you too. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard. So I'm wondering if it's true, first of all, and what kept you writing poetry?
It is true. I started writing poems at 13 or 14, which I think is like that sweet spot for so many of us when we're experiencing emotions that we don't quite have the words for, all that teen angst. And so I started writing poems around that time. And I mean, if I were being serious, I would probably say that poetry is one of the only things that I found really at home doing. I was not a sporty kid. I was not in a lot of clubs or organizations growing up, but when I wrote poems, I felt like myself, and I felt a sense of accomplishment, even if I never showed it to anybody else, you know, just for me, like, oh, I said what I came here to say, or I described that, and I got it into words in just the way that I was trying to, and that sense of being able to create something that I felt good about kept me doing it.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, writing is always deeply personal when you're writing essays or, you know, stories about yourself. I think poetry is doubly so. I think it's even more personal. I'm wondering if you faced any internal struggle with opening up to the world, with sharing your work with the world, and what that looked like for you when you first did.
Well, I'm still an introvert, but I was an extreme introvert as a kid and as a teenager and even really into my 20s. So I remember the first time I had to stand up in front of people and read a poem I had written, and it was terrifying because it's very different having a conversation with yourself on paper.
Right.
And then, you know, squirreling it away under your bed or into a drawer or whatever, and it's very different standing in front of people and saying these, you know, very private interior thoughts that you were having. It's funny, when I was in high school, I used to put my poems in a manila folder in my locker, and I would give trusted friends the combination and let them check out my folder of poems, and they could just jot down notes on them, but I didn't have to sit there with them while they read the poem.
Oh.
So it still felt a little bit private for me. And as I get older in the art, I'm less nervous about being myself and my poems and sharing my thoughts. And I think part of that is just a function of growing up. You know, in your 40s, you care a lot less about what people think of you than you do when you're 18. Thank goodness.
Yes, thank goodness. Thank goodness, right? I always say, you know, if you can give your kids one thing, give them confidence in themselves, because it's so important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your latest book is called Goldenrod, and I'm sure it's hot off the press here, but I'm sure it's going to do extremely well. It certainly, you know, I read through the poems, and a lot of them really made me stop and think. So I just want to talk a little bit about the book, and then I'd like to look at a couple of the books. And if you have the book handy, I'd love you to read a couple for us.
I do, sure, of course. I take requests, or I can pick some. It's up to you.
Okay. So I've got a couple. So let's just look at the book itself, first of all. The collection is described as a celebration of contours of daily life. You explore the space between thought and experience. Remind us that we decide what's beautiful. How did this collection begin for you?
Well, a book of poems is written sort of differently from any other kind of book in that you don't sit down to write a book of poems. You write one poem at a time, usually over several years, if you're like me. It takes me a little time. And then I print out everything that I've written since my last book of poems was published. So that last book was Good Bones. So at a certain point, I printed every poem out that I had written since Good Bones came out. And I had hundreds of poems.
you know, more than a book.
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of go through and decide what poems are in conversation with each other, which ones seem like they want to travel together. They have shared concerns or similar imagery, or they really seem like they want to live between two covers. And that's sort of how I pulled the book together. So the poems date from 2015 to 2020. So it's, you know, 5+ years of work.
Yeah. And so the second poem is called Goldenrod. Why did you call the collection Goldenrod?
That's a good question. Part of the process for me is, like, the title is always one of the last things to happen. And that's the same with poems individually. I don't usually come up with a title and then write the poem. It's always in reverse. The poem tells me what the title should be. So when I gathered all the poems and I had them in the order that I wanted, I went through all of the poem titles to try to find the right title for the book. And there were a few front runners, but Goldenrod won. And I think one of the things I really like about this as the title is that the scientific name for the plant, goldenrod, solidago, means to make whole or to heal.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, and I didn't know that, of course, when I wrote the poem. I was just looking out a car window at yellow flowers.
Right.
So doing a deeper dive and finding this sort of metaphor, even in the word, that it's a, you know, the plant is known for its healing properties. And I thought, you know, this book and all of these poems in the last several years of my life have been, you know, challenging personally, and we've been through a lot of challenges as a country and globally, and it felt like the right gesture to have the title be something related to healing.
Very appropriate. And the topics you explore, I mean, they're simple everyday topics that we all deal with, universal subjects, if you will. Parenthood, solitude, love, animals, birds. You know, a lot of writers, I think, get caught up in, I have to have this big idea. And some of the most powerful work comes from really simple, everyday things. Don't you agree?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think one of the quickest ways to ruin a poem is to try to write a big poem about big things. Usually, I find that I'm more successful, and the poems that I read by other poets are more successful, if the writer gets at those big ideas via the specific, the small, the particular. So, you know, starting with a small observation and then sort of pulling the camera back and letting the reader reflect themselves on what that really means and what the bigger implications are, rather than going for the big idea right off the bat.
Yeah. One of those examples, you wrote a poem called Not Everything is a Poem, and that was sparked, I understand, by two rocks and an acorn that you found in your son's pocket. So you're pulling these out of your son's pocket, and tell us how that goes from there.
So there are actually a few poems in Goldenrod that reference these, what my son calls nature treasures. And he has a habit, and has since he was very small, of collecting acorns and rocks and feathers and, you know, dried clover, whatever he can find on a walk. And he'll put those things in his pocket for me to find when I do the laundry. Or he'll slip them into my coat pockets or my purse pocket so that later, you know, a year later when you're pulling the coat out that you haven't worn for a while,
right.
I'll slip my hand in and find a seashell or a dried dandelion head from the previous spring or summer. And so those things to me have taken on the sort of metaphorical big idea significance, and that when I'm walking at night, say, and I reach my hand into my pocket and find something that he's left me, it feels like a good luck charm, like a talisman.
That's lovely. Another of your poems you was sparked by the bane of my life, autocorrect.
Oh yes.
Do you know, I have a standing joke with a friend, because one day I signed off my voice text, I was using voice text, with Dylan, my dog, sends big doggy kisses. And unbeknownst to me, as I sent it, autocorrect changed Dylan sends big doggy kisses to ceiling fans. And I get a text back saying, okay, I give it. What the heck's with the ceiling fans?
Yeah, autocorrect has turned us all into surrealists somehow. Yeah. And nothing makes much sense at all.
Yeah, and tell us about your experience and how Rose Has Hands came together.
Should I read the poem?
Yes, I would love you to read that poem.
Okay,
yeah.
Let me read the poem and then I can talk a bit about it. Rose Has Hands. My phone doesn't observe the high holidays, autocorrecting Shana Tova to Shaman Tobacco, Rosh Hashanah to Rose Has Hands. Apples and honey for a sweet new year, or apples and honestly, or news and years, always more than one. Yesterday, my daughter asked, out of what felt like nowhere, but must be a real place inside her, when people kidnap kids, do they kill them? Why would someone kill a kid? When I texted my husband this, my phone corrected kill to Killarney, kid to kids. We have two. My phone suggests their names, suggests what the duck, suggests news, years, and honestly, what truth can I tell her? I don't ducking understand. I don't understand ducking any of it.
I love that. I read that twice when I first read it because I thought it sums it up beautifully.
And I can read that poem thanks to autocorrect because it has saved me from saying the word I could not say otherwise.
Okay, there's good to it then, yeah. As well.
sometimes our autocorrect saves us, and it's one of those poems where I feel like tempted to giggle at parts of it, but it's also incredibly heavy at the same time, and that's. I think a balance that many of these poems strike is that the sort of light and darkness that we live with all the time. You know, we all have a lot of hope, and in each day, if we're lucky, has these bright, beautiful moments, but we're also living in difficult times.
Right.
And the days are hard too, and sort of being able to live with both of those things.
Right. And actually, that's a good segue, because one of my favorite poems was How Dark the Beginning. And that poem begins with, all we ever talk of is light, let there be light. And toward the end, it says, let me speak on behalf of the good dark.
Yeah, I mean, this poem is really born from the idea that the dawn, like the beginning of a day, starts at 12:01 a.m. And it's pitch black out at 12:01 a.m. So the idea that we have many hours of morning or many hours of a new day before the sun even comes up. And that felt metaphorically true to me, that sometimes the beginnings of things are hard and dark, and it's hard to find our way. And what we need to do is just keep our eyes ahead on the horizon and trust that that light is going to glimmer and that the sun is going to come up. And that it's, you know, sometimes we just have to be patient and right. Know that it's coming.
Right. I also find comfort in the dark sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's the good dark. I mean, I find comfort in the dark too. I also, you know, I also like a sad song. I also love a thunderstorm. I mean, not everything has to be sunshine and rainbows to be pleasurable, right?
Right. And you know, there's that old adage, if we don't have rain, we don't see rainbows. So this...
Exactly, yeah. I mean, every time it rains here and the kids are like, oh, we can't play outside, then one of them will usually remember, but the flowers get a drink.
Right.
Somebody's winning, even if in this moment it's not us, and that's okay.
Right. Now, you put the book, the poems into three sections, if you will, in the book. Why did you do that? Tell us what's going on there.
So the poems, there are three sections of 18 poems each, and mostly that's because I'm slightly superstitious. So my lucky numbers are 13 and 18, and that is because my birthday is the 13th. And my children both have birthdays on the 18th of the month. And so I did a little bit of superstitious poet math with this book and divided it into three sections of 18 poems each as sort of an homage to that lucky number. But I think, you know, tonally, the book moves into some sort of darker waters in the sort of mid part of the book. And then in my mind, at least, it kind of bumps back up a bit toward the end, because I like to end on a little bit of a hopeful note, not the everything is fine, we have nothing to worry about note, but a little bit of hope and light there at the end.
Right. And one of those that I think offers that is Bride. That's toward the end. I wonder if you'd read that to us and explain what's going on there.
I've got it.
Okay,
this is Bride. How long have I been wed to myself, calling myself darling, dressing for my own pleasure, each morning choosing perfume to turn me on? How long have I been alone in this house, but not alone, married less to the man than to the woman, silvering with the mirror? I know the kind of wife I need, and I become her, the one who will leave this earth at the same instant I do. I am my own bride, lifting the veil to see my face. Darling, I say, I have waited for you all my life.
And what sparked that? What sparked that for you?
I mean, that is an end of marriage poem. I am still married, and yet I actually feel more partnered to myself than to this person I feel fairly estranged from, though we are living in the same home. So the idea of the woman silvering with the mirrors is feeling more, sort of more partnered with myself in my own solitude, as my hair starts to turn. And so, I think it was sort of born from both a kind of sad impulse, but also a kind of resolve of actually I'm my best partner. I will grow old with myself.
Yeah.
The image of lifting the veil before the wedding kiss, and the image of it being you, like you're the person who's come to save you.
Right. I think a lot of people will be able to relate to that.
It does seem to be one that people are attaching to. And I think, you know, whether they're divorced or happily married or single and never been married, I think the big idea of it, of sort of being whole in yourself, regardless of what your relationship status is, I think does speak to a lot of people.
Mm. I want to ask you this, because when you write a poem, it obviously has specific meaning to you. And I've heard you say that when you release something into the world, it really becomes public domain. And we all know that people interpret things so differently. For example, when Good Bones was first published in 2016, I believe, it hit a nerve because it went viral. But you actually wrote it about something entirely different in a different, I think it was the year before, is that right?
Yeah, the context of that poem changed because of the week when it was published. So I wrote Good Bones in the summer of 2015 at a coffee shop with nothing particular in mind other than the fact that I had two small kids and we're living in the 21st century and I don't know how to explain things to them. I mean, there are terrible things happening in the news all the time that my kids at that age were not privy to. And it felt very strange to both keep them from those realities and have to hold them myself.
Mm.
And so the year later, when the poem went viral, it was attached to the events that were happening in the world that week, which was Joe Cox being murdered in England and the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. And so erroneously, it was reported often that the poem was inspired by one or both of those events. It just happened to be published the same week.
Right. Do you feel the need to kind of correct perceptions when they're like way off base, or do you just give it up to the reader and say, hey, it's fitting the time, so, you know, enjoy?
Yeah, I mean, I can't follow the poem around and be sitting with every reader while they read it to make sure that they get it. So I have to be willing to let go. Although if someone, you know, asks me, what does this mean? Or I think this means this. What do you think? I'm perfectly willing to tell someone that their reading is off base if they ask. But I have to be willing to let the poems have lives of their own. And that means that once they leave my hands, the relationship is between the poem and the reader.
Right.
And it's not really for me to interrupt or get in the way.
Right. Do you have, I'm sure you're going to say no on this because everybody does when I ask them if they have a favorite story or favorite character, whatever. Do you have a favorite story in Goldenrod?
Oh,
a favorite poem.
Oh, you know, I don't have a favorite poem in this book. But I mean, I do have probably a handful of favorite poems I've written over the course of my life, but I never want to like say that in front of the book. It's as if you're talking about your favorite child in front of
right.
all of your children.
Right. That's what I hear a lot of. Well, give me some commonality. Is there a commonality that makes them your favorite, or is it maybe just you're writing about something that's deeply personal to you at that time?
You know, I think the poems of mine that I like the most are poems that surprised me when I wrote them. That sense of I sat down with a little scrap of language or a couple of words or an image, and then the poem that ended up arriving and sort of being built over, you know, hours or days or months or sometimes years was not at all what I would have expected when I sat down with my pen, you know? And because those poems tend to stretch me in ways that then make the poems I write after that more possible, because now I've done something different, and every poem I write after that, maybe it'll have, you know, I've learned something from the process of writing that different poem. So it seems to me that some of my favorites are actually the strangest ones, because they came from places I can't quite describe or really explain myself.
Right. That is interesting. I've heard you talk about what Buddhists call beginner's mind and the importance of keeping beginner's mind. What does that mean for you in your approach to life, in your approach to work?
Well, I think it's just what I was saying, that feeling of being open to discovery and not thinking you know already what's going to happen when you sit down to write. And that really is a metaphor for everything, right? Like, I remember my doctor asking me before my first child was born to give her the birth plan. And the birth plan included a lot of things like, I'd like to play this kind of music, and I'd like to have a natural childbirth, and I would like to breastfeed, and I would like to do this. And then when push comes to shove, really what you need is just a healthy baby.
Right.
And most of the stuff in the birth plan just gets thrown out the window because you just don't know what's going to happen. Parenting is like that also. You know, sometimes you just have to be willing to kind of go with the flow and let go of your expectations for what you thought it was going to be like or what you think it should be like. And the same goes for writing. You know, one of the ways to shut a poem down is to think you know best when you sit down with your pen. And so part of that beginner's mind is just its openness and receptivity and being willing to just kind of put your antenna up in the air and see what comes and welcome it without censoring yourself too much in the process and kind of shooing it away or shutting it down. And just seeing what happens. And then later you can put your editor hat on and censor yourself a bit more and polish things up. But in the beginning, being receptive is the key.
Yes, and I love spending time with little kids and obviously with dogs. I'm a big dog lover, because they always have this joy and curiosity that I find contagious. And I saw you do an interview in a room, and maybe this wasn't even your room, Maggie, but on the bookcase behind you was a sign that said, joy is an act of resistance.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you meant by that.
Yeah, so it's a little banner, and I'm looking at it right now. It's now hanging in the front window of my house. So when people pull up to my home or the mail carrier comes up or someone pulls into my driveway, it's the first thing they see because it hangs in a front window facing the street. It's actually a line from a Toy Derricott poem, Joy is an Act of Resistance. And the way I read it is the idea that finding joy, finding pleasure, finding happiness or contentment or peace in the midst of difficulty is a way of pushing back against that difficulty. Not letting everything get you down, finding that one little bright shining spot, even in a really hard day, is an act of resistance. It's an act of, I mean, you're fighting for that.
Mm.
And some days really do feel like that, don't they? Like we're just really fighting and hanging on tight
lately,
that bright light.
Yes, I think a lot of people would say yes to that lately, for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing about reading poetry like this is that you realize you're not alone. I studied British literature both here and in Britain. And, you know, there's a lot of poetry involved in that. And to be honest, I never understood the serious analysis of it all. But what I did take away from all of that study was the connection that, hey, you know, somebody like 1,000 years ago feels exactly as I do today.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel not so alone.
Yeah, that's I think what draws so many of us to either reading or writing poems or both. And it's that click that people feel when they read a poem where someone has articulated something that you have felt or experienced or seen or heard, and you've never had the right words for it, but here this person has just handed it to you on a silver platter.
Right.
And it does make you feel less alone because you feel seen and understood. My editor says all literature is self-help in that way. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
Like everything that we read makes us feel less alone, more seen, more understood. And that's incredibly therapeutic.
Yes, I remember being obsessed with Keats when I was going through my divorce about, you know, because a lot of his, he died so young, as they tended to back then anyway, but he would write about, you know, I have to get these words out of me. I have to live my life before it's too late. And of course, he died very, very young.
Yes.
But that was a driving force to me, those poems written many years ago, to, you know, if you're going through this, let's make it really different. Let's do something really different.
Yes, I love that.
And so I'd love if you would read one, if you choose a poem to read for us before we go today. But I'm wondering also, as you put Goldenrod together, I know the poems were written over a 5-6 year period, but I think each time we put a project together like this, it changes us a little. We learn something from it. We take something away from it. What have you taken away from Goldenrod?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think one of the things I realized when putting the poems together and seeing how they were communicating with each other is honestly how much I've learned about life from my kids, how much wisdom I've been gleaning from them, sometimes without even realizing it, till I go back to the poems and I see that so many of the most meaningful images or pieces of dialogue or metaphors are things that come from conversations I've had with them or experiences I've had with them. And so that was a real gift, like getting to see them all together and realize how much, you know, I think, you know, we think that we give so much to our children, like, well, you know, we take care of them, we're in that role. But in my case, I've been able to see the ways that they've cared for me and tended to me over the years, unwittingly.
Yeah. There was a poem in there about your daughter in the blue sky and the trees. And I thought then, you know, there's a wealth of resources from just watching and observing and listening to kids.
Yeah. I mean, that Maybe I'll read that poem. It's a really short one, but and I can find it. There are a few poems in this book that are really came from conversations that we had, and this was one of them. And it was, we were driving in the car and we saw a tree trimmer cutting down a tree across the street, and from the back seat of the car, my daughter said something about the blue sky getting to fill in. As soon as a limb comes off the tree, the blue sky must feel so relieved because it can finally flow in, you know, like water,
right,
into
right.
that space that's been carved out. And so I ended up writing this poem, and then I added the title to kind of build the metaphor. So I'll read that one.
Okay.
The poem is called "At the End of My Marriage." I think of something my daughter said about trees. When a tree is cut down, the sky's like, finally, and rushes in. Even when you trim a tree, the sky fills in before the branch hits the ground. It colors the space blue, because now it can.
It's beautiful.
So the metaphor is just really, you know, is really in the title. The idea of, you know, freedom, the freedom that you feel, even though something has been removed, but maybe there is a gift
right.
there too. Maybe there is some freedom there too. But it really just came from her observation and then me hearing it as metaphor.
Right. Yeah, I love that poem. It's beautiful. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, and I'm seriously going to go check out your other work now. I really liked it.
Lovely. I love that. That's great. I feel like that's the best compliment, and I feel the same way. If I read a poem or a book by someone, I want to go hunt everything down, just like if I hear a song by somebody, I want to find all their other songs. So I think that's wonderful. Thank you.
And I know listeners can find out a lot more about you and your work and your other books at maggiesmithpoet.com. A final thought you'd like to leave us with today, Maggie?
Oh, goodness. I guess I would just say I would love for people to keep in mind that that darkness is part of mourning, too, and that light's coming. And if we're just patient, it'll show up, and that's, you know, to everything it's season. So I know we're all still going through a lot of things here in this country and just globally, and it feels overwhelming at times. But I don't think it needs to be. I think it'll be okay.
I agree with you. And I thank you for being with us, Maggie Smith. Great talking with you.
Thanks so much.
And the book again is Goldenrod. It's a book of poems. My guest, Maggie Smith. You can find out more about her at maggiesmithpoet.com. And if you'd like to share feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net. Please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.